Oh, and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader through United Communities in AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Our topic today is managing your property with conservation and ecology in mind. Our guest speaker is Matthew Hunter. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Matthew Hunter is a consulting wildlife ecologist, a field naturalist, bird enthusiast, and guide. He has over 35 years of exploring, studying, and experiencing the diverse ecosystems of the Pacific Northwest. Could you tell us more about yourself, Matthew, and how you came to find yourself doing this kind of work?
Well, I'm also a husband or father of three and owner of 5 acres in Melrose, which I really enjoy. I started out in college not really being sure what I was going to do, but having grown up on a couple hundred acres, I had a lot of interest in things out of doors. So that got me started on that track and learning bird songs and that sort of thing when I was late in high school, probably led me in that direction.
Cool. I met Matthew virtually when I recently brought 16 acres in the area and I found a salamander in a vernal pond on our property and I didn't recognize it. I reached out on Facebook and Matthew was able to tell me what it was, identify it as a species of interest in the area that's not often seen. And I was thrilled to realize that I had something neat on my property. And I began to think how I might manage my property with the interest of the existing species in mind. In your experience, Matthew, I can't be unique in my excitement about this kind of discovery. Do you find that as common with people, especially out here in the Pacific Northwest, when they buy a piece of property?
Yeah, I think it varies a lot. Some people buy property with more utilitarian goals in mind. Some people buy property to just enjoy it. But regardless, people seem to be interested in what's there. And they're curious. There's always things that, you know, surprise people when they start walking around their property, things they haven't seen before and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we bought this property kind of blind and I didn't realize how much poison oak and whatnot was on it and bramble. but other than that, I'm amazed with the diversity of wildlife I have. When people come out here to the Northwest and they buy property, can you characterize the type of people who buy a tract of land, like over an acre or so? Are they looking for privacy? Are they looking to protect their property? Are they looking for their own hunting grounds? Are they just looking for peace and quiet? Do you find a trend or a trend that has grown?
Not that I'm aware of. I've met all those kind of people you just mentioned. So people have all kinds of different goals.
All right, we were mostly looking for property for the dogs. And
yeah. And
then we found out what a neat property it was. I had no idea of this pond on the property. So that was a kind of a cool find.
Yeah.
So as a new landowner with ecological management in mind, can you walk us through the first considerations someone should take, like what you should look for and why on your property?
Well, I think that mostly has to do with your own goals. If you are wanting to just kind of promote natural diversity and that sort of thing, it's good to just spend some time out there and walk around and look. One thing that I even experienced myself is just to go out to a spot and look around and keep looking. And the more you look, the more things you see that you didn't see just a minute before. So I think just starting by trying to familiarize yourself with what's there. And even different times of year, because things are constantly changing seasonally, and animals move in and out of property. So things are always changing. So something to get a feel for what happens different times of year. So I think the one of the first things is just to spend some time out there trying to get familiar with things. So people tend to want to, label things, but find out what species they have and that sort of thing. And that can be a daunting task for people if they haven't done that before. And so sometimes you can get help from people like myself or other local groups that have people with a little more expertise If you're more of an individual learner, then there are books for just about everything and some online resources. So I think it's good to just start by getting familiar with what you have. And then eventually you kind of want to know how your property fits in the whole local landscape. You might be just the same, your property might be basically the same as everything else around there, or you might have some unique features that you might want to enhance or preserve. So those are a couple things to start with.
Yeah, and I guess when you talk about seasonally, I guess that would really apply perhaps to birds who seem to be more migratory of a species. Watching seasonally who comes through, because they might only be here for what, a month or something on their way through, but there's still an important species visiting you on your property and depending on it, and depending on it to be managed ecologically. Well, if you did, like I am trying to do, decide to manage your property as an ecosystem in the best interests of the animals and the species, can you tell me maybe some of the economical benefits of doing that?
You mean to yourself, like to the landowner?
Yeah, like perhaps maybe native species require less watering, so your water bill goes down, for instance. Or
Yeah, that's for sure. I've planted quite a few native species around my place, and it's really nice that I don't have to really worry about them because so long as they have enough room to grow, the right environment, sun versus shade, that sort of thing. They just are quite happy, and yeah, I don't have to do much of anything with them. Where some other things, crops and stuff that other non-native plants usually need a lot more care. Economically, I guess I haven't thought about it too much economically, but yeah, if you do plant native species, it's usually they, if they really are native to this area, you kind of have to be specific with, are they native to this area or just native to some other part of Oregon? So they may or may not do real well here. You kind of have to make sure you get species that do occur around here and are used to the amount of rainfall and temperatures and stuff that we have here.
right. What about, do you know anything about tax benefits that you might gain through managing your property as a tree farm or a forestry or something? Does the state of Oregon, to your knowledge, support homeowners who are trying to maintain a healthy property tax wise?
There is that what is it? Oh, Wildlife Habitat Conservation Management Program. I think ODF&W is the one that kind of oversees that. And that works basically like a farm designation or forest or that sort of thing. So you end up getting a tax break. I looked into that here for my property, and I don't remember exactly why, but I decided to not go that direction. I don't remember if it just wasn't enough savings for me or it was a lot of work because of the reports and stuff. I don't recall exactly, but I decided not to do that. I thought, well, I can just do what I want to do. But if people are interested, there is that program, and you can just search for it on the internet. Wildlife Habitat Conservation and Management Program through ODF&W, and
Right.
they've got a lot of information online that you can look at.
Of course, I wonder if the resale value would be more or less. I guess that depends on the potential buyers. If they want a wild looking property or a natural looking property or a much more cultivated property.
Yeah, there's that. And there's also well, once you start tying, the state into any government, into how you manage your property and into your taxes and stuff, then that can affect people's taxes if you go to sell the property. There's also federal programs, conservation easements and that sort of thing that can allow you to federal conservation easements will actually allow you to get a little money to do some habitat restoration and that sort of thing. But it's also something binding on that property. And I think you can set it up in different ways, but basically that kind of goes with the property, and some people might like that, and some people might not.
Yep, some people might shy away from
Yeah.
that burden on them. But I can imagine the aesthetics and the health and the quality of life, at least for me, is much improved when I look out on my property and it looks like a forest. It looks natural.
Yeah, I think people that don't even, know exactly what's going on there kind of recognize natural beauty versus maybe you'd call it land abuse, land that's just been really hammered generally isn't very beautiful. But land that's cared for and looks lush and rich and diverse, it usually has some beauty that people can see. When I lived in Corvallis, I just had a Well, it was about a quarter acre lot in town, but I actually took out my grass and planted lots of native species in there and put a path through it and all that. And so when we went to sell the house, it was actually some people that were botanists and plant enthusiasts, and they were just nuts over that. Whereas a lot of people would just want to cut it all down and put grass back in. But anyway, that What I did there attracted a certain kind of person.
Great. And I mean, I think that would be comforting to you as a landowner, knowing it was going to someone, the next guy, who's going to keep it in the same kind of quality.
Eventually, it probably won't be there, but
Right,
maybe for a while.
Well, more and more people are moving out here because they have access to what seems natural property. I was in the on the East Coast for many years, and anywhere you went, nothing you saw was native. Like it was a big deal. It was like an Easter egg hunt to try to find a native flower. And it was a big deal, or native grass, or a native anything. And it was a big deal. And out here, it's incredible because most of the things you find are native. And that was really exciting to me. How do you identify the important, significant, or interesting ecological aspects of your property? I mean, you told me to start off, you just have to get out there looking, but could there be something that you'd be looking for in particularly? Like, would there be, especially in our area, in the Umpqua watershed, are there specific plants or species or birds or critters or even ponds or geological pieces that are kind of neat and they indicate a property that's more, that has more diversity or potential for more diversity than others? Like, are there things you should look for in particular that say, oh, that's cool?
Yeah, there are quite a few, really. So I don't know that I could list them all, but there's certain things, almost any kind of water, natural water source is something unusual. There are people that, of course, live right along the river, but people that have smaller creeks or ponds, even human-made ponds, but even rare is any sort of natural wetland, that sort of thing. Those are extremely rare in the Umpqua Valley. There are certain types of patches of shrubs, even like some patches of ceanothus or elderberry, native shrubs that have lots of berries. Once you get up farther into the Coast Range, they'll be a little more common, but they're not very common down where most people live. There are some patches here and there of higher percentage native grasses, but those aren't very common either. The whole area's been grazed for a really long time, and so a lot of the grasses are non-native grasses. What else? Rock outcrops. Rock outcrops are usually places where you might have rattlesnakes or ringtails, which is a small, interesting looking mammal. Even just some big trees, some properties have Big old oaks or big old madrones or ponderosa pines, that sort of thing. So those are a few things that are a little more unusual that most properties don't have, and a few people do have some of that.
So I should know this. The madrone is native then, is it?
Yes.
That's a fantastic tree. What makes it, it's cool. I've never seen one. What makes it so successful here, and why is it value, why is it a valuable tree? Why is it so unique, and why do people treasure it here?
Well, some people treasure it, some people don't like it at all, just because it sometimes comes back pretty thick, and when it grows up, if it's in a pretty homogeneous stand, then almost nothing grows underneath it. But when it grows mixed in with other species, and at a bit more spacing, then it doesn't really hinder as much of the undergrowth, and it instead of sort of being homogeneous, it just contributes to the diversity of a stand. And because it produces so many berries, especially in the winter, during a good madrone berry year, we can have tens or hundreds of thousands of robins and waxwings and other birds feasting on the berries. And then, like a lot of fruit producing, nut producing trees, sometimes there'll be a year with lots of berries and another year with not very many. And we can really see the numbers of birds that hang out during a winter when we have years with lots of berries.
Oh, see, that's interesting to me. I didn't realize that it was a fruit-producing tree. So that's going to be exciting for me this winter.
Yeah, in fact, right now I was just noticing some of my madrones. The berries are turning nice and orange.
That's cool. I'll go out and look out after this interview. You talked about the wildlife habitat and conservation and management plans. What are those exactly? And are those something an individual can do? Are they something that's state required? Is it to homeowners?
Yeah, well, basically, the whole program, I would say, is generally analogous to the farm programs or the forest programs, where you can't just, you have to have some sort of plan to get these tax breaks. And so for the wildlife version of it, you have to develop this plan that ODF&W would approve. And then you follow through with it, and they check on it every once in a while. And individuals can work those up themselves. I think ODF&W recommends you find a wildlife professional to do it for you. And they can help you with it as well. So that can be done either way.
Almost sounds like making a will. Everybody can make their own will, but they all advise you to get a lawyer to make
Yeah.
sure you have all your bases covered. Yeah. I just wonder, I've been advised in a couple ways out here. I'd like to keep my property as natural as possible. I just enjoy it. And I know that a down tree, a fell tree, provides more habitat than one standing up in general to more species or something, is from what I understand. But other folks are telling me to clear everything out in the interest of like fire mitigation. How might a management plan incorporate issues for both of those, fire mitigation and still maintaining cover for animals and species? Is that
Yeah.
possible?
Well, yeah, it kind of depends on how large your property is for that, because I think they're almost whatever, no matter what you do with your property, some kind of animals will find it as habitat. Whether you clear the entire thing and burn it down to bare soil, or you protect it and let it grow to this just thick, massive, tangle that you can't get through, or something in between. There are certain animals, of all different types, birds, amphibians, whatever, lizards that will use that habitat. It will just be different for those different habitats. So in essence, you can't go completely wrong in terms of you're not going to get rid of all critters, but there are things that you can do to enhance certain types of animals that is up to you what you would like to enhance. But mixing that with fire safety, especially around dwellings and that sort of thing, I just think a wildfire planner would be a better person to talk to about the specifics of this. But if you basically work in fire breaks in your habitat, if you want some areas that are a little thicker, that's fine. You just need to have a fire break next to it so that if fire does happen in that thicker area, that it doesn't continue on up the hill towards your house. So, you can have just a large area, maybe of some grass that you can mow during, before fire, the really dry fire season or something. But so you don't have to turn everything into fire safety land, or you don't have to turn everything into a specific, high cover area. So, and one thing about cover versus more open areas is that animals will use the more open areas for travel. And up in the woods, there's people that put out trail cams that makes it really obvious that there's lots of animals that would prefer to walk on a well-established hiking trail or an old forest road, logging road, than just through the woods because it's much easier to walk through the open areas. But when they need hiding cover, then they dash into the thicker area. So both types of habitat can have a benefit, and a good mix is really nice. Now, if you happen to know, some places like the deer through in my area mostly are going east and west, I think because they go over to the river. So if I wanted to have travel corridors and hiding corridors, I might want to orient them in that direction. But
Yeah, that
so,
makes sense. You'd mentioned this earlier, but is any property too small? You'd mentioned you had a property in Corvallis, I believe, that was small, but you were able to manage it ecologically, correctly, I guess you might say. Is there any property that's too small or that you can't do a little something on?
I don't think so. Even in my 5 acres here in Melrose, I spend most of the time doing plantings and stuff right around my house. And that's largely because I want to enjoy seeing things while I'm doing things around my house. And the rest, of course, my house, it's been here for, I don't know, 50 years or whatever. And I haven't been here for 50 years, but just to point out that as different people have lived here for over the years, the areas closest to the house are the ones that turn into, driveways, mowed grass, gravel, and not very lush habitats, So, whereas the farther I go out, it turns into more grassland, oak savanna, shrubs, and that sort of thing that I don't feel like I need to do much with. Whereas right around my house, I've added lots of, I have lots of like wood chips that I use for landscaping, and things like sharp-tailed snakes love that, wood chips. And I've also put in a artificial stream right next to my house, so I provide this water, and then I've got all kinds of native plants in and along the stream and in some other patches with lots of berries and flowers. And so there's birds and hummingbirds and in the summer butterflies and stuff out there all the time. So even in a small area, if you provide berries and flowers and a little cover and certain plants that have small seeds and stuff for the small birds. I've actually stopped feeding birds, both seed and my hummingbird feeder sits out there dry, because I've got enough plants now that there's lots of food and I just don't need to put out feed anymore.
Which I guess is better for the bird population anyhow, not to be depending on humans for their food, from what I understand.
And the bird seed usually attracts rats, which is introduced rats, so that's not very fun either.
Those are non-native rats, like the Norwegian or whatnot. That's always a problem. Well, what about, are there any laws, and I've come to find there are, that restrict what you could do with your land out here? When I was out east, we would dig ponds all the time everywhere and fill them with goldfish and frogs and whatever. But I was told out here I cannot dig a pond, that water rights and water concerns are an issue, and that I need permits and I need this and that and the other to dig out a pond. Are there things like what is the deal with the water? Are you able to put in artificial water structures in your area?
So it's different by state. In Oregon basically claims ownership of any water that falls on the ground and runs along. If you catch the water out of the air, just in an open basin or off your roof, then as I understand it, you can do whatever you want with that water. Now, that probably gets into some legal technicalities that I'm not qualified to talk about, but as I understand it at this point, that's the way things are in Oregon. So I got a permit to put in a pond at my house. I've since decided to not do that, but that pond needed a permit because it would be just collecting some rainwater that ran down a slope to the pond location. Now, if I just had some sort of basin, or if you have a watering trough sitting out there collecting rainwater that falls from the sky, you don't need a permit for that. And similarly with my stream, my water feature that I put in my backyard, it's about 120 feet long, but it's lined and it doesn't collect rainwater from the slopes nearby. It's separated hydrologically from the slopes nearby. So again, it's self-contained. And so that doesn't need a permit either.
I understand. So if I had a fake pond liner or one of those deck ponds, that's certainly allowed. Oh, that's cool. Okay. Well, what happens if like a homeowner identifies an endangered species on their property, like one that's federally protected? Does that now put restrictions on you?
The what I know about it is that if you have a species, federally endangered or threatened species on your property, the rules about take apply. In other words, you're not supposed to do anything that hurts or hinders that species. In other words, if you find a threatened or endangered species nesting in a tree on your property, and you go and cut it down, least if somebody knows about it, then you could be fined for that. In general, I mean, very, very few landowners have any threatened or endangered species on their property. You know, in terms of families and individuals that own some property, the large, industrial landowners, of course, they own so much land, they of course have threatened and endangered species on their property, and they're totally accustomed to doing what they need to do to deal with that. But most individual landowners don't have any threatened or endangered species on their property. But it'd be kind of interesting to see what happens if you did. A few species, well, things like, for example, the bald eagle that aren't threatened or endangered anymore. At one point they were. And occasionally someone would have a nest on their property. These days it's a lot more common for people to have, say, a bald eagle nest on their property. Maybe if you own some land along the river or near a lake or reservoir or something, but it's still pretty unusual for people to have threatened or endangered species on their property.
What about something as easy as a butterfly garden, a pollinator garden? That's fine, even if it's even if you're planting non-native flowers and items to attract those butterflies, that's okay.
Yeah, I mean that's, really common. People plant all kinds of things in their yards, and natives, non-natives, and if maybe a Fender's Blue or some sort of unusual butterfly comes by, most of the time nobody would ever even know that that happened.
Great, great.
It'd be super rare, even for a butterfly enthusiast or expert to even see one on their property, unless you had like a large area that could potentially attract a population of that species. And most of those are really key to specific plant species as well. So, unless you had those, it'd be super unusual to even see one. And for the rest of us, we would never even know if one showed up.
What if you were the guy who brought in the blackberry, I don't know how many years ago, and I guess that blackberry, the non-native blackberry, is from South America, I believe. That's what my research has told me. What if you were to bring in some kind of invasive species like that and it took over like it has? These are the things I'm thinking about as I'm looking at our property.
Would be embarrassing if
It'd
you
be
were,
embarrassing.
I don't know what that person would feel like. A lot of things were brought here initially. Because they thought they would be beneficial, usually economically. I don't remember about the blackberries, but people brought bullfrogs here for bullfrog farms, and same sort of thing with nutria, and some of the fish and all that. People all thought they were good for good reasons. We just didn't have the really full understanding of what the eventual impact would be.
Right. And I guess we have native blackberries, don't we?
Yes, most of our blackberries are non-native, but we do have one or two species, depending on who you ask, that are native.
I kind of like our non-native blackberries. I have animals that eat only those blackberries. So for me, they've been kind of a treat. But I understand the non-natives are really water hogs and take much more water than the plants around them is one of our problems with the non-native black.
They do end up kind of taking over, if they're not held back. One of my pet peeves with the non-native blackberries is just the access restriction they cause for me when I want to, say, go down to the river or go down to the edge of a pond or something. And if the blackberries have really taken over, then it's really hard to get through there.
Right.
And if you fall into them, you know, that really hurts. So they're kind of they'd be less annoying maybe if they didn't have all the thorns, and that just makes it worse with all the thorns. But they do end up, you know, certain areas taking over that space that could be occupied by other species. So, and at this point, unless somebody comes up with some genetic control mechanism for things like Himalaya blackberry, they're basically with us. And I think just reducing the amount in certain areas is probably the best we can do at this point.
Right. What about another one of my favorite species since I've come out here? Out east, we had turkeys, and I guess they're native out east, and you never saw them, never could see one. If I did, it was the best treat in the world. Out here, of course, we have flocks all over, and I just love them. And then I came to find out that they are non-native as well. And it seems that folks out here either love them or hate them. What about the turkey as an invasive species?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. There are several examples, and I'll give another one in a minute. But so certain subspecies of turkey were native to other parts of Oregon, like North Central Oregon, and but the turkeys we have these days were brought here and released here in the Umpqua Valley, and they were mostly brought here, released here, and kind of maintained by ODFW as a hunting opportunity. But the turkeys end up finding, you know, good places to eat, whether it's people's gardens or certain crops, or and then there are people that do just love them, and so they feed them. And but sometimes their neighbors have things that the turkeys then go over and dig up and eat, and so there can be these, you know, family feuds, so to speak, about the turkey lovers and the turkey haters. And not really sure how that's going to end up in the next 10, 20 years here in the valleys. The if you do have a real serious problem, ODFW will come and trap them and take them elsewhere. But of course, they just keep reproducing. They'll be back eventually. So I'm not really sure what the solution is here. When they're around my place, kind of depends. You know, if they just move through, then I don't bother them. But I have a lot of stuff I don't really want them to eat or ruin or dig up. And so I'll go out and let them know that there's sort of a human predator around here. People with dogs usually don't have as much issue, you know, with whether it's deer or turkey or whatever. So that's one thing that some people do to keep them out.
Yeah, I've loved them, and the dogs do love them as well. There's nothing funner than chasing the turkeys up the tree, and they're back the second the dog goes in. They're right back.
Yeah.
But I've gotten a real kick out of them. I kind of love them. People tell me I'll learn not to, but I really love them. They just stay in the trees around my house, and I'm not a gardener, so they're not hurting my garden yet.
Yeah. Yep.
Were you going to mention another? You had mentioned another species like the blackberry or the turkey. Were you
Oh,
thinking of another
well,
one?
yeah, in terms of the whole native species topic is we could spend a whole hour or two talking about that, you know, philosophically, psychologically, scientifically, everything. But another, well, because the turkeys were maybe not native to our area, but were native for, you know, just 100 miles away, and that's just for a certain period in history, and that's sort of one of those issues it's interesting to talk about, that whether something is native or not just has to do with what time period you look at. But another example that I thought was interesting is a few years ago I learned that there were signal crayfish in Crater Lake. and they were calling them non-native. I thought signal crayfish is our native crayfish. And I just hadn't really thought about or realized that originally there weren't any in Crater Lake, and that somebody had somehow put them in there, probably. So that's just an interesting example where, I mean, all around Crater Lake in all these watersheds in Western Oregon, there are signal crayfish. That is our native species. But however those crayfish got into Crater Lake, apparently originally there weren't. And so they were calling that a non-native crayfish. And so, I mean, it just brings up another example of how, well, how do you define what's native and what's not native?
Right,
So.
right. It took me years to realize that the brook trout is not native, that that's an eastern fish. And then when I visited Twin Lakes recently, that's what they're stocking it with. So we're stocking these upper mountain lakes with non-natives. It's a beautiful fish. Is it ever too late? Can independent landowners make a difference in the ecology around here? I know a lot of the area has been timbered. I know there's a lot of cattle grazing area and sheep grazing area. And those are valuable ecosystems as well, and I'm sure for different game birds and whatnot. Is it ever too late for a homeowner to try to restore their property to a natural state?
I don't think it's ever too late. You know, whether it's your land or your life, I think there's always opportunities to take steps to make something better. So, and that's the only way anything is going to get better is if you take a step to make something better. And you can do that on your property, your life, your connections with people and anything. And I think that's how the change happens.
Right. And I guess if your neighbors is cutting down everything on their property, but you're maintaining your property, I guess that can only help, right? Or are their efforts going to hurt your efforts?
Yeah, that just again depends on your goals. And just as sort of a course example, if let's say if you lived out in the middle of a forest, especially maybe in a mid-range industrial forest or something where everything had 100% canopy of Doug fir, and then and one person maybe cleared their 5 acres or something, well, where do you think all the elk are going to be, or the robins, the bluebirds? They're all going to be in that open area.
Right,
You know?
right.
And whereas if you're in a big open area and you're the only person with cover, then and maybe the only person with fruit bearing trees and shrubs and stuff, well, where are the critters going to go? When they
Right.
need cover or something to eat, then they're going to go to yours. So what's valuable can change in a different landscape context. And you
Back to,
can
oh, go ahead.
even sometimes, if your neighbor does something very different from you, that can be really beneficial. You know, if you provide the cover and they provide the open forage, or vice versa, you can end up providing a good mosaic of habitat with different emphases.
So almost complementing each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I've been concerned that our property is so thick that am I a fire hazard for my neighbors if I don't clear out?
Well, you could be. And you know, there are companies. I don't know if DFPA provides input to something like that. I bet they would. There are also companies I've seen that evaluate and actually do the labor to, and you can get certified like fire safe and that sort of thing for your property. But you can, there are definitely people that can give you input on that specific for your property.
Well, I'd be crushed if we took out the trees around the pond, for instance, and that pond dried up even earlier than it did this year. And I guess if we removed that cover, that would expose that pond more to evaporation and whatnot.
Yeah, and I don't think they would, you most of the time, like I said, you should talk to a fire professional, but from what I understand, a lot of times they're looking at ground level, 10 feet and under kind of brush, the what they call ladder fuels, so that because usually it's not really very common to get canopy fires unless you've got ladder fuels that bring it from the ground up into the tree canopies. So they mostly focus on lower down the brush.
Right. That makes sense. That makes sense. Extending from our talk about non-natives, do you have an opinion on when non-natives become naturalized? Does that happen? And how long does it take? And is that okay?
Well, yeah, I don't really have an opinion. That's just kind of a judgment call on when they become naturalized part of the ecosystem. And then beyond that, it's also just kind of a judgment call when we start saying, well, is that okay or not? I think people look at it from a couple different angles. One is some people get all worked up about any species that isn't native to our area. And I don't know, end up getting kind of disgruntled towards that species and stuff. I don't find that as really very helpful. I think it ends up causing us kind of a lot of emotional anguish and anxiety and stuff. I think we need to step back and take a broader view of the ecosystem and the diversity and the function, what's going on out there. Is this harming something or not? And then the other aspect is when a species really expands its population so much and overtakes a lot of other species to the point of really diminishing the diversity and even causing trouble in particular systems, whether it's certain aquatic species plugging up culverts or dams or taking over certain aquatic areas. I know, like out at Flateye Reservoir, there are tons of red swamp crayfish. And of course that's an artificial reservoir itself, so well, does that really matter? I don't know. I don't even know if there are any native fish in there. People that like to eat crayfish like it when the crayfish take over a spot like that, because there's
Right.
lots of crayfish to get. But, so when the species really takes over, if it's in a more natural area and it's going to end up converting that area to something that's relatively homogeneous, that's something that's maybe not a good thing. At least just shows that things are kind of out of balance.
So bottom line, the more diversity you have, probably the better. And more native diversity, probably the better.
Yeah, well, usually diversity usually means more stability in the system. Not that we want things to just be completely constant and stable. There's always an ebb and flow of things, but I don't really think it's really more of an issue of values and philosophy and stuff. I know people try to make it into a kind of a science thing, but and there is science that we can use to understand why things are happening or why things are changing this way or that way. But in terms of how we want things to be on the land or in the water, that ultimately My perspective is more of a value judgment, which just gets more into, philosophy and human psychology and all that kind of stuff.
That makes sense. What if you have different species that have different needs? What if I have, I don't know, I can't think of two species off the top of my mind, but let's say I really want to protect this area for the amphibians, but then I have more a different species that would need a different need and would benefit from a different type of management. I'm not exactly sure what I'm saying, but is there a species that you would serve first when you're looking at your property? That you would value, not personally value, but a species maybe that indicates a greater ecological benefit or value of your property.
Yeah, I don't know. That would just be a personal call. I mean, you could make a judgment maybe based on what's the more unusual or species or a smaller population species or something like that. But that whole scenario is pretty much constant because anything you do is going to benefit some species and be a detriment to other species. Even, in our area, we're very familiar with all the timber harvest and that sort of thing. But the thing is every stage of the growth of a forest, there are species that do better in the early stages, middle stages, and later stages. So there are species, say like bluebirds, white-crowned sparrows, lazuli buntings, that are more open area species that you won't find in the depths of a dark forest. And then species like spotted owls or during the breeding season, the varied thrush or hermit thrush, and others that during the breeding season like these more extensive older forests that during the breeding season aren't out in the open areas. And then I keep saying in the breeding season because some species will change their habitat use during different
Right.
seasons.
And it's also when you see most species when they're out breeding
Yeah.
or looking for mates, yeah.
So, yeah, if there is going to be a choice on which way to go, you could think about and probably get some input on what species are more unusual for the area, and you could try and emphasize that if the other species are basically taken care of by everybody else around, and you've got a good opportunity to take care of a less common species, that might be something you can do.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, as a wildlife ecologist, how do you keep up with the science in your field? And if somebody wants to be like you and keep up with you, what are the resources around here that they might follow, or how do you keep up?
Well, these days I'm sort of slowing down a bit on all that keeping up, but there are different ways of thinking about it. There's a lot of very specific science, and studies and research that goes on that I keep up with less than I used to, but I think I'm focusing more on bigger picture these days and thinking about human interactions with our planet and in the landscape. So I think I pay more attention to that these days. And most of my the things I'm aware of and the things that I learn is more by spending time out there. And I do read papers and try and read stuff and just follow other people that are out there doing the same thing. But most of what I learn comes from just being out there and observing myself. And I have spent a lot of time submitting observations to places like iNaturalist or eBird, online repositories for data like that, so that, you know, as more people contribute information like that, then you can start to see some patterns that you wouldn't see if it was just you. So having all that conglomerate data, you can end up seeing some patterns that you might not notice all by yourself.
Well, and like I said earlier, that's how I met you virtually, is yep. putting a species up that I had that I didn't recognize. That was a fantastic situation. I'm so glad I did.
Yeah.
Matthew, this has been wonderful. You've been such a knowledge base for us, and I'm so glad you took the time to meet with us today. And I want to thank you for your time.
You bet. I'm glad to be here.
All right. And this has been an episode of Living Downstream. Thank you, Matthew.
All right. Take care.
Take care.